Hello, GIST podcast listeners. Podcast, an audio medium. But really, I've been gearing up to make the big time. Yes, the GIST is now on Instagram. We started an Instagram page. It's a way to foment discoverability. I just always, whenever I was doing my interviews, I never realized that what I really wanted was to extract a one-minute clip with subtitles and big block letters. But it's really cool, and it's a really good way to help people find the show, because people don't pass around audio, but they pass around video, and we're populating the Instagram feed. Please go to PescaGIST if you're on Instagram, or join Instagram in order to go to PescaGIST. It's Tuesday, March 4th, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The GIST. I'm Mike Pesca. The tariffs are on and the reports are in.
Look at the reaction on the big board today, all right? So the Dow at the moment is down 1.4%. You add that to yesterday, and you're about 2.8% off in 2 days of trading. The NASDAQ is down even more. It's about 3.6% overall in just 2 days now.
Donald Trump imposed an additional 10% tariff on imports from China, bringing the total to 20% on Chinese goods. He also implemented a 25% tariff on almost all imports from Canada and Mexico. Now, who's going to retaliate and on which goods? Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said, "I am," and Chinese President Xi said, "Great idea. We will also tariff soy." And Sheinbaum said, "No, by soy, I mean, yeah, it's fine. Go ahead." Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, whose party no longer trails in the polls thanks to moves like that one from Trump, called Trump a smart guy. This is the reverse Zelensky. But he still pointed out that these are dumb tariffs. Trudeau imposed a 25% retaliatory tariff and made the case that this wasn't about trade, but about Trump's actual efforts to make Canada the 51st state. That really is ridiculous, but it is helping Trudeau's party in the polls, and it is accurately quoting Donald Trump, and as they say, all is fair in love and trade wars. Trudeau calling the tariffs dumb, also an accurate quote of the Wall Street Journal. This was their headline: Trump takes the dumbest tariff plunge. For all of Trump's charges of fake news, the Wall Street Journal nails this one. Now, remember, their audience is Wall Street, and Wall Street has absolutely pronounced this trade war dumb. The Wall Street Journal used to market itself as the Daily Diary of the American Dream. I tend to think if there was a Daily Diary of World Freedom, it would call Trump's Ukraine sellout dumb. If there were a Daily Diary of actual government efficiency, it would call a lot of what Doge is doing dumb. But those entities or those ideas, freedom, functional government, they don't have stock tickers or incremental price changes. Too bad. I bet they would be pointing downward. At this, the exact moment that President Trump is addressing the joint houses of Congress to tout his vision and, quote-unquote, accomplishments. At least when the stock market gives strong signals, Trump has been known to relent. With all else, he is more or less relentless. Tomorrow, we'll have a full Ukraine assessment with Charles Kupchan, veteran European expert in the Clinton and Obama State Department and a professor. Tonight, if you care to join us over at the Dispatch, we'll be doing a live stream reaction right after the president's speech. It's for Dispatch subscribers, but it's also for Pesca Plus subscribers. If you are listening on the Pesca Plus feed, I will link to that in the show notes. If you are not, go to subscribe.mikepesca.com for this and all other manner of goodies. Yes, like our live show with the Fifth Column in Manhattan on Thursday. Okay. And now, the rest of this program. An interview I've been very eager to bring you. The Scopes monkey trial. Not about monkeys, but it really was a trial of the century. It's fascinating what makes for trials of the century. And the author and historian, Barbara Wineapple, certainly agrees. She has written Keeping the Faith, God, Democracy, and the Trial That Riveted a Nation. And she joins me next. Brenda Wineapple was here a couple of years ago, and she had written a book about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. And I have to tell you, it was just about the best book I read that year because it filled in the history of a period and an event I thought I knew, but I didn't even know a scintilla of. She performs a similar trick. Perhaps it's a miracle, you might say, in her new book, Keeping the Faith, God, Democracy, and the Trial That Riveted a Nation. Brenda, welcome back to The Gist.
Pleasure to be here. Hi.
Hi. So this was the Scopes trial, the Scopes monkey trial, the so-called, at the time, trial of the century. But when I look back at the list of trials of the century, and you might find this interesting, you go to Wikipedia and look up that list. The first trial of the century is, in fact, you want to guess what it was?
Leopold and Loeb?
Well, it was a century before, and the first trial in Wikipedia that's listed as a trial of the century is the impeachment of Andrew Johnson.
So is it really?
Yes.
So they've got the wrong century.
Other trials of the century throughout time have been Leopold and Loeb, or the trial of Harry Thaw for the murder of Stanford White, or Sacco and Vanzetti, or O.J. Simpson. What do these all have in common? Murder was the case. Maybe not with Johnson, but murder was the case. Then it comes to a history teacher named Scopes, and the stakes are $50. So how'd this become? And does it actually earn the appellation trial of the century?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, a trial of the century means, among other things, that it's going to get national coverage. And when you think in 1925, about 200 journalists descended on this little town in Dayton, Tennessee, it's rather remarkable. And it was covered in China, it was covered in London, it was covered in Johannesburg, it was covered internationally, which is shocking when you think about it, because this is a little town in the middle of Tennessee. The Tennessee legislature passed a law outlawing the theory of evolution being taught in public schools or colleges that were supported by the state. And suddenly it was front page news before, during, and a couple of days after the trial internationally. So that makes it a trial of the century. And you really don't need necessarily murder, but you need some sense of injustice, I think. And that covers Leopold and Loeb, because that was a trial of the century because it was such an awful crime. People probably know that these two teenagers killed a third teenager for no reason at all, just because they could get away with it. Or Sacco and Vanzetti, or later in the century, the Rosenbergs, and you mentioned O.J. Simpson. You know, those were about treason was the Rosenbergs, race is O.J. Simpson. And here you have this little town talking about the theory of evolution. It's right. Really remarkable when you think about the coverage of it. So something is going on.
In the list you just gave, I think two of the people were innocent. Ethel Rosenberg, arguably, probably, and I always forget if it was Sacco and Vanzetti, but the other one was clearly an anarchist who threw a bomb. Scopes wasn't innocent. Scopes really did break this law called the Butler Act. And was that even something that was in question, or something that Clarence Darrow, who was brought in by the ACLU, was trying to argue?
Not really. What Darrow was after, and the ACLU, who was at the trial as well, that's how the whole thing started. Darrow and the ACLU knew that Scopes violated the law. That's, as you mentioned, the Butler Act basically said that you cannot teach the theory of evolution, that, you know, the divine creation of man is taught in the Bible, and teach instead that we're descended from a lower order of animals. That's the actual law. And Scopes violated it. He taught from the textbook. This is the irony. One of the many ironies is that he taught from the textbook that was authorized by the state of Tennessee that talks about evolution. And Scopes said, well, you can't talk about biology, can't teach biology if you can't teach evolution. And it was in the state authorized textbook. But a law had been passed some months before, and it outlawed, ironically, as I said, the teaching of evolution in this particular book. So Scopes, when when the ACLU was looking for someone to violate the law, to say that they had done this because they wanted a test case, it was to them a constitutional issue, and this would be something that they could alert people to by defending Scopes. Scopes stepped up, and he said, yes, I violated the law. So when Darrow came to town and the defense of Scopes came to town, they weren't saying that Scopes had violated the law. They were basically saying that the law itself was unconstitutional. And the larger issue for Darrow was that it's actually un-American.
So how, a couple questions about this. One, at the time, how old was the ACLU?
Oh, only 5 years old. And that's relatively new. It was founded pretty much after World War I, so 1920, war's over 2 years before. A lot of the people who had been involved in an organization to support, again, civil liberties, particularly the people who, like the head of the ACLU, Roger Baldwin, who'd been protesting the war and refusing to sign up for the draft. Well, that organization kind of morphed into the American Civil Liberties Union. And one of the things that it was trying to do is alert people to what civil liberties were and when they were being violated, which they were quite a bit in the 1920s and actually before. So this was a way to get people informed, not just about the ACLU, but about civil liberties, both of them.
How familiar was the strategy of seeking out test cases that the ACLU was using here, that later the NAACP would use with Rosa Parks? In 1925, was this an established ploy?
No, I don't think so. It's a good question because I don't think so, because the actual organization is pretty new. And I know that the secretary of the organization was actually going through newspapers looking for cases that they could bring some publicity to themselves in the case. So I think there was probably precedent in the law for doing this before, but not necessarily for the organization. And it, you know, frankly, it worked.
Did the ACLU want to turn this into the trial of the century, or was it really more a counter move because William Jennings Bryant was attached to the case for the prosecution?
Yeah, you know, the timing is difficult. It's almost as if it was a perfect storm. Yeah. Bryant got involved, the ACLU got involved, Darrow got involved. Almost simultaneously. It's hard to map out who got where first, but there was an organization called the World Christian Fundamentalist Organization. That's a mouthful. And that organization was just as it said, it was an organization of fundamentalist Christians, not liberal theologians, not liberal practitioners, not Sunday school teachers or scientists who consider themselves religious, but it was a particular sect of Protestantism that was extreme, and they wanted and they believed in a literal interpretation of the Bible. So the best example I could give is to say Eve was literally taken from Adam's rib. You know, mm-hmm. This is not a metaphor. So they, when they heard about this trial going forward, that Scopes had broken the law, they contacted William Jennings Bryan to prosecute the case. And for Bryan, that was an offer he couldn't refuse. At the same time as the ACLU now and the fundamentalists and Bryan are involved, Darrow heard about this, and he volunteered to take on the defense of Scopes without a fee. So he was folded into the ACLU. He was just about to become a member, hadn't quite become that. So nobody intended it to be the trial of the century, but Bryan, who always liked publicity, as did Darrow, to be fair, really, he said that he was going to fight a duel to the death on behalf of Christianity.
Was the ACLU excited about Darrow's participation, or did he draft himself and thrust himself into it in ways that leadership maybe didn't 100% support? And this, by the way, since you're writing about cases, this is a leading question.
This is a leading question. This is a question that has the answer right embedded in the question, as you already know. But people wouldn't necessarily know that. And I would have assumed the ACLU is glad to have Darrow. Darrow is the most famous criminal and labor lawyer of the century, of the 19th and the 20th century. He had just come off the Leopold and Loeb case, by the way, where he defended Leopold and Loeb, again, not because they were innocent. They were as guilty as you can probably get of a really malicious and terrible crime. But he defended them because he didn't want them to get the death penalty. You know, and it's remarkable that he won. They did not get the death penalty. So the ACLU was a little leery, to say the least, about having Darrow, because to many in the ACLU, Darrow was a publicity hound, he was a celebrity, and they wanted to fight this battle in much more sedate terms.
Yes.
And constitutional terms. For them, it was a...
Right. So that's my question. What were some of the... Darrow just wants maximal attention, and then he pulls this thing that you would think was just invented or concocted to advance the drama of a drama or a movie of cross-examining William Jennings Bryan. But it really happened, and we'll get to that. But my question is, what were some of the differences in the way Darrow wanted to defend the case, which was maximally attention getting, and the way the ACLU preferred, which was to lay a foundation that the courts would one day enshrine in law?
Right, because the ACLU basically wanted this to go to an appeals court, which is a step toward the Supreme Court, and get this in front of the Supreme Court. That's what they wanted to do. And they thought, coming from their point of view, you want a conservative constitutional lawyer to fight this. And people as well known now as Felix Frankfurter, members of the ACLU, they were estimable members who were arguing for that. And let's just keep this, as I said, sedate and really on point, which is the Constitution. Darrow, by contrast, those are important issues to him, make no mistake. But he really felt that there were larger issues at stake and that you had to do really two things. One is educate the public to what was going on. And two is to make very clear what was going on, and which was, according to him, an attempt to turn the country into a bigoted, intolerant theocracy where only one version of the Bible could be taught. Now, that's a constitutional issue right there. In other words, it's a First Amendment issue, just separation of church and state. But Darrow is really going for the newspapers, and he wants to get everything. He wants maximal coverage because he knows that an important member of the court, if you will, is public opinion.
And we'll be back with more from Brenda Wineapple after the break. We're back with Brenda Wineapple, author of Keeping the Faith, God, Democracy, and the Trial That Riveted a Nation. And I want to know, to what extent were Clarence Darrow and the defense facing headwinds of popular sentiment as regards teaching evolution in schools? Because the Butler Act in Tennessee, that was enacted 70 years after The Origin of Species came out, and teaching evolution wasn't disallowed for many, many years. The official textbook of Tennessee taught evolution. So my question for you is, was the Butler Act seen as an expression of a sentiment that was out there, that was a popular sentiment? No, even though it's been 70 years, we don't want evolution taught. Or was it more of a reactionary, even radical expression of even Tennessee sentiment?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I, you know, And I like the word consensus because the consensus was the theory of evolution has been around for a while. It's a no-brainer. We already had these arguments in the 1860s, 70s, 80s. People like Thomas Huxley was fighting for it. And so it kind of calmed down. So my question was exactly yours in a different point of view. Why was this such a big deal? This is what we would call today settled law, although nothing's settled anymore. Why is this so unsettling? And is it really about the theory of evolution or something that the theory of evolution represents to people? And I think it was more about what it represented because nobody really understood the theory of evolution. Even in the textbook, it said theory of evolution is change over time. So there's no big deal here necessarily, but suddenly it's front and center because of many things that are going on in the 1920s all come to a head around this particular issue. As I said, symbolically symbolizes change, that something is wrong in the country and it's all, and it goes back, must go back to Darwin, because somehow we're not being taught morals anymore. There's something going on. Mm-hmm. It's a very, as I said, unsettling. It's a very uncomfortable time. Simply put, let's not forget this is the Roaring Twenties. This is the 1920s. When we think of the 1920s, we might think of, you know, jazz, and we might think of, I don't know, flagpole sitting. I don't know what we think of anymore.
Flappers.
Flappers.
Gin.
Yeah. Speakeasies.
That's the man that fixed the World Series.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, The Great Gatsby was published in 1925. Right. You know, Calvin Coolidge was president. People have automobiles. This necking, as they called it, in the back of cars because cars are new. You know, so there's, that's the popular idea of the 1920s, but the 1920s is also the time of tremendous intolerance and you know, the fear of what were called Bolsheviks or communists, because there had just been a revolution in Russia, and there had just been an enormously destructive and incomprehensible war, the Great War, World War One, which had, you know, slaughter on a massive scale and introduced new weapons of then mass destruction, like mustard gas and aerial bombing. It's terrifying, really, and in so many ways. Plus 1924, you know, to get in the weeds just for a second, the, you know, Congress passed laws prohibiting more immigrants coming into the United States, because there was such an influx of immigrants coming from the turn of the century to the 20s. And there was a sense in which, well, what is America anymore? We don't know what America is anymore. Everything seems different and weird. And there's an Einstein saying all things are relative. And so you can see this is a time of fear, really. And one of the ways of understanding that fear is fear of change. So what are we going to get back to, in a sense, is what is the issue is being raised here. How can we get back to, as according to Brian and the fundamentalists, something fundamentally good and pure about this country? And what is that thing?
Right. Give me that old time religion as the
well.
Jingle
and
went.
You say that, give me the old time religion. This is the time, excuse me, when the Ku Klux Klan is enormously popular. You've got the Klan members in Congress. They're sitting in governor's seats. And just about a month, less than that, after the Scopes trial sort of tells you what's going on in the culture at the time, in August, the trial's in July. In August, there's a huge Klan march in Washington, Pennsylvania Avenue. And there's about, you know, estimates vary, 10, 20, 50,000 Klan members.
Right.
In their hoods and white sheets.
Right. Birth of a Nation, President Wilson.
Yeah.
I've seen history written in lightning. This was all right after that era. And William Jennings Bryan served in the Wilson administration. But the great trauma, World War I, which you mentioned, servicemen coming back or not coming back. And William Jennings Bryan, if Clarence Darrow saw this as a proxy fight between tolerance and intolerance, as you write in your book, that Bryan saw it as humanity versus technocracy. Germany was aligned with technocracy or technology, and the technology was aerial bombing and mustard gas. And so the consequences of technology were these horrors, and he would espouse religion, which was at least anti-technical. So there was something very progressive about his retrograde stance in the 1920s, wasn't there?
Right. He had been a progressive, you know, and in a sense, the way we use the term today, a progressive, is the same way we could use it to Bryan in many ways. His progressivism was to stand for what he called the common people, and he was called the commoner, and he had a newspaper called The Commoner. And so he wanted to stand for the common people against what? Turn of the century up into the 20s, the robber barons, the Gilded Age, much like ours in many ways, you could say. And he was horrified the way corporations, monopolies, what he called plutocrats, as I said, had rolled over the farmer, the plain, the people out in the plains, the workers, who had no say in this new land of money. At the same time, he assumed Darwin. He misunderstood Darwinism and theory of evolution. He understood it as social Darwinism, the survival of the fittest. And to a certain extent, not only did he associate the war with, as I said, mustard gas and aerial bombing, or as you say, technology can run amok, which, you know, one is understandable. He also associated with the kind of Prussian idea that might makes right, which was the survival of the fittest. That's social Darwinism, and has nothing to do with Darwin, but what he thought the theory of evolution implied was the brute survival of the fittest, which allowed the strong to exploit the weak. Well, that makes sense from a progressive point of view. The strong are these captains of industry, and the weak is everybody else who are being exploited. So in that particular way, he's enormously progressive, and his point of view is progressive.
So how much, I mentioned this before, it really did happen. It's not just a scene from a movie that would make every lawyer roll their eyes. It really did happen that William Jennings Bryan was called as a witness because he declared himself an expert on the Bible. And then Dara said, okay, let's call you to the witness stand. And then, well, as you document in the book, a lot of what we saw in the movie or read in the play really was reflected in the transcript. So my question is, did the trial, well, we know the results of the trial, but how important was that to either public perception or what the ACLU was trying to do in lay a precedent? Did it really hurt the case, even though the case was ultimately won by the prosecution?
Well, you know, me personally, I don't think it hurt the case at all. There may be others who would argue that it did. But if, you know, as you yourself said, we all know, or not all of us, but, you know, people have seen him. There was a movie, there was a play, you know, this became part of the kind of public fabric of America, this trial of the century. And that was partly because it moved outdoors. And Darrow and company put William Jennings Bryan on the stand, which, you know, every time I speak to a group of lawyers, they're all kind of slapping their foreheads and saying, this is unprecedented. This is, you can't do this. And even then, of course, people were saying, you putting Brian on the stand, and the other members of the prosecution wanted him off, and the judge the judge was trying really hard to be fair, and he also wanted to hear Brian, and Brian wanted to go up there because, as we were just saying, he was a politician, he liked the limelight, and he really thought it could do a good job. So here you have the most dramatic scene possible. Everybody, the newsreel cameras, the reporters, the spectators, the kids selling hot dogs, they're all outside on the courtroom, outside the courtroom on the lawn in the hot July sun. They set up a kind of platform, and Darrow's up there in his shirt sleeves, and Brian is there in his shirt sleeves, and they're both sweating. And Darrow lets Brian have it. And Brian thinks for a long time he's doing a good job, but they both lose their tempers. And it's stunning and shocking. And when you say people, the sedate group in the ACLU, are kind of horrified by this and think that the case is really lost, because it really did become a farce at this point. But there were others who felt Brian had so impaled himself and his own literal reading of the Bible, and he basically, Darrow caught him in a trap almost inadvertently when he said to Brian, you really believe that the earth, that everything on the earth, humans were, God created the whole thing in 6 days? And Brian said, well, not 6 days. Literally, it's kind of figurative. And it was, you could almost, 100 years later, you could almost hear the gasp. It's like, oh my God, you don't believe what you say you believe?
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, the prosecution is standing up and the judge is standing up and everybody's upset. And Brian realizes what he's done, and that's it. So, of course, no, I shouldn't say of course, but the defense lost the case. Scopes was guilty. They knew that. But they had really gotten what they wanted in from one point of view, which yeah. was to reveal the limits of understanding the Bible this way. It had nothing to do with religion. It had nothing to do with evolution.
The name of the book is Keeping the Faith, God, Democracy, and the Trial That Riveted a Nation. Brenda Wineapple joined us. She is the author. Joined us again. Thank you so much, Brenda.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And that's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. Michelle Pesca is COO of Peachfish Productions. And Leo Baum is sometimes around to be an intern, but he's also rehearsing for the variety show, which is very important. Oompru-jee-pru-doo-pru, and thanks for listening.